The second part of this session has a very catchy little title, Discography in the Digital Age, Numerical Obsession Meets Mathematical Algorithms. Why don't you come on up now? This is actually going to be three people. Go ahead. David Deal, who is at the Texas State Technical College, and has been at many ARSC meetings, he's going to be the leader of the session, and along with him, LDR. Along with him is Sam Berlaski, who's going to be talking about the Library of Congress, and Richard Green from the National Library of Canada. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We'll have a few technical moments here, but I'd like to say good morning to everybody. Hope we're having a good time so far. I owe the title of this presentation in part to Tim Brooks. I was interested some time ago in the Columbia personal records of the 19s and 1920s, and they were only covered selectively in his magnificent set of Columbia master books, which he co-authored with Brian Rust. And he said that basically a complete listing would only hold interest for the numerically obsessed. Since he had just published all these books, I thought that was possibly the pot calling the kettle black. But anyway, it's also kind of telling that there are actually two ARSC presentations with the word obsession in their titles. So only two that I noticed. There may be more. Anyway, to continue with our theme of discography in the 21st century, I'll just start out by discussing a few general considerations, and then we'll hear from a couple of folks who head to the most prominent institutional efforts in the field of electronic discography. And then finally, we'll move on to the question of standards and the Association for Recorded Sound Collections. ARSC is a unique organization. It's one of the few, maybe the only one that I know of, that brings together archivists who manage substantial institutional collections of recorded material. We also have industry representatives who own the rights to at least some of these same materials. And we also have individual collectors. This is critical because collectors and archives often have items which the legal owners have discarded or lost. The industry, of course, by and large, holds the data about the recordings, which collectors and archives would like to acquire. But collectors are specialists who themselves may have knowledge in depth. Archives, of course, have the wherewithal to publish information through books and their fancy electronic catalogs, beautiful web pages like the Library of Congress, and also reference services directly to researchers. I think we got a good introduction to the history and practice of discography. I would just note that since it is obviously a derivative of bibliography, there are some similarities that we should kind of mention. let me see. Descriptive bibliography is something that most non-librarians and non-book dealers don't know too much about. It was used by antiquarians to describe the minutiae of the really early books, and it has a very close analog in the discography that we use today. It's not really similar to bibliography as, you know, MARC records and that sort of thing. They're more likely to be interested in changes in text from edition to edition. That's why someone would compose a bibliography of the works of Shakespeare, for instance. So record collectors, as I heard somebody mention not too long ago, are constantly seeking information about recordings which is not included in archival cataloging. If you go to most library sites and use the catalog, even in the off chance they do have 78s in the collection, it's not going to give you the details that you're likely to be looking for if you're putting together a discography. Often issue numbers are suppressed, they go to lengths to make it uniform with the rest of their catalog, and our interests as collectors may not be very well served. But there has been quite a discussion on 78L, if any of you were members of that, and also I believe once or twice on ArsCalist about electronic discography. The potential of electronic media for data exchange and validation would seem to be pretty self-evident, and a great deal of discographic information resides in a variety of institutional catalogs, CD-ROM products, and individual efforts like Brian. The great thing I see about Brian is that it does kind of invite people who may have a specialized interest to go ahead and give it a shot. The biggest obstacle is really, as far as I can see, just getting data digitized. There have been lists floating around for years and years where collectors jot down little notes. I imagine if you go to estate sales of collectors, you will find old copies of hot discography where someone has gone in and put in all sorts of details, and it never gets put into some centralized database somewhere where people can actually access it. Most people, we just saw a good example, sort of, discographies, would-be discographies, are usually based on word processors if they expect to be published. Ordinarily, unless you've really made an effort, databases don't do a wonderful job of reporting things in a nice format. You know, you can get it out, but it doesn't look all that publishable. So you just typically go for a word processor in that case. My printout seems to have lost some of my presentation. Thank you very much. Okay. Yeah, that's right.
Just make it up. Dude.
That's right. Just make it up as I go along. For someone like me, I have preferred to go to the route of the internet. And for that, I've gone with good old HTML. I don't have to hire a consultant or find someone who's highly skilled in computers to get the job done. I can do it myself. But it has certain shortcomings, as do all the others. We were talking about exchanging data with other formats. If you've got your stuff in a relational database, good luck trying to transfer it to any other relational database. There's so many connections, and you can see, especially when you're making it up as you go along, there's no way to make those connections match up very well. Okay. Why don't we go ahead and talk about the AVRL project, the American Vintage Record Labelography.
Thank you. Yeah, I can speak from here, I guess. Yeah. Well, I didn't ask to speak on the subject. And Dave wrote me a few days ago just to tell you a little about what this is. As you recall, Kurt Nock and I sort of simultaneously, almost 10 years ago, sort of started thinking about the potential of a national database, or at least a cumulative database, based on all this work that people were beginning to do in databases for the first time 10 and 15 years ago. Without going through the history, we had a programmer that dropped work on it. So it gave us some time to, lots of time to rethink a new approach and how we might best go about working on a discography. We're not sure whether the programmer owned the name AVRL, so we've sort of just thinking about it as a national database. So we were going to call it the American National Database, but people thought that, using the word "and" would not work in Boolean searches, and, or something like that. So In the past year, Bill Klinger, who has taken on much of the work on a national database with me, he and I have been to see one potential funder, and the funder has shown some interest in it, but it's a private foundation, but really felt we weren't quite ready. He wasn't assured even of our capabilities to really pull it off at the scope we wanted to, but he did set some important ground rules for us that if he were to fund it, one of which was that data actually had, everything had to be public domain, which was to mean it, if it were to be created, it would be given out freely. It would be like census data is the analogy I use, where the government produces it and gives it away for the cost of the programming, and then other people create maybe money-making things out of it. And that was fine with us. But we thought that really the best thing to do is, particularly since our programmer had dropped out and so much had happened in computer databases in the past 5 and 10 years, was to really start over. And so the funder considers it, and we have continued discussions with this one funder, we thought we would go back and sort of start afresh and look at a database structure that might be a model, or might be what we wanted to call a universal database structure. A pretty presumptuous goal and undertaking to think that, we're going to come up with some structure and we're going to impose it's going to be the database structure for the world. But we got some good discographers in a room with the help of the National Recording Preservation Foundation, or National Recording Preservation Board, which is funded by Congress to assure audio preservation, but also access as it relates to audio preservation. So with a small amount of funding from the Recording Preservation Board, we brought some discographers to the Library of Congress last November, and we sat around the table and we thrashed out what we might be, a goal to be a universal discography structure. I might add that we also hired a programmer, analyst, to be there and throw in ideas, tell us when we were too far off, and then give basically what we came up with, which was a list of tables, to this programmer to come up with a data model. And then we'll take the next step. The recording board might be able to maybe even build a database, a real database, not just a structure, around this model, and then we'll use it to test data. But the point is, we got some really good discographers, many of whom are in this room, together to just, brainstorm about what fields are necessary and how they might relate to each other. And it is a relational database that we came up with, of course, because we are thinking about starting with 78s, and the one thing we know about music through the 78 era, with very few exceptions, is that they are events in time, and they are unique events in time. And of course, there are records on 78 that were fudged with and represent several time frames. For the most part, they're 3 to 5 minute moments. So the discography structure is not session based per se, but there are fields that one can put in time and place, and we think that through post-processing one can recreate a session. But it isn't a discography structure that's really geared for jazz specifically, or to really look like Russ and some of those other things. It's really thought of as a every field you can think of. I almost think of it like, if you ever took any kind of information science theory, Cobb's rules for relational database. This is sort of our rules for what a discography might include. It has about 200 fields in it. And the 200 fields are repeatable. Well, it had 132 fields, but many of them are repeatable, and many of them have what we call relator codes. And I don't want to go into too much of the detail because it is vaporware at this point, but I think it was very important to get people in to think about what a discography should be, and then to give it to the programmer. And then in about 2 or 3 months, once we hear from our programmer, it will be put up on the ARSC list. We'll put it up on a website, the Library of Congress, or somewhere else, to let everybody have a crack at it, to look at some of the other programs, look at Brian, look at some of the other things, and see how they relate. But a few things I just want to say about how we put it together. One is to not reinvent the wheel. Use the best of other things that are out there that we've seen, and even as I looked at Brian, I saw some ideas. So we might have a lawsuit in a few years if we get started. Like, Xerox Parks, mouse, GUI interface. But also, the idea was to use as much of standard library cataloging work. That is to say, don't reinvent the wheel. Use name authorities from databases that exist. When Steve was talking about, you know, how they construct names in Brian, that is the way libraries construct names. Libraries first do a name. If there's a conflict, first they do a birth date. But then they do the skill or role. So you do see, you know, Smith, comma, John, comma, dancer or bassist. I mean, that can be. So in a sense, that isn't so different, Brian, than a way the library would work. But what we'd like to do is use the Library of Congress name authorities and title authorities, which are generally classical now, but there's no reason why they couldn't be broadened to include pop music or folk music, but to keep that same structure and interface with them. Because one can buy these products on CD-ROM. You don't have to have a mainframe anymore to access the National Bibliographic Utilities. The other piece of it is, as I said, and then in the same way with what we call relator codes, library fields list people, just as this database did, and there's sort of a little thing afterwards about what people do. So we will have one big names database, not a separate one for composers or performers, but with the name will be another field. It's what their relation is to this particular recording session, this recording event. At the same time, we're very concerned about the fact that we're not cataloging records, it is a discography, so you're really cataloging matrix sides. So we gave a lot of thought to how not just alternate takes would relate to one another, though it's important that they be able to be seen together, but how you know, alternate takes or takes that have Kirk can help me on how we were looking at some of the exceptions to just a different take where it has the same matrix number but with a different issue where they use the same number. Mike and Mike Gray and Kurt will talk about this exactly for a lot. And we're trying to relate those so you can see those. In any case, the goal will be to have a database structure, and then the next thing to do is to commission a database based on it to test it out. And then what we want to do, and this is where I'll have to disagree a little bit with David, is to come up with a way to relate these relational databases to each other, to other databases, to Brian, to even WordPerfect files, if that's what they're going to be. And that would be through an XML definition, a document definition in which one, or schema as they call it now, that it allows for the exchange of data between two databases or two files. And there might be one in which converts this to a certain view that's flat, because we know that most collectors, if they aren't using something like Brian, if they keep a database, it's generally a flat database. But if we have a set structure, we can continue to create XML schema to go back and forth between those databases so that we can exchange data. So for now, the goal is the structure. We hope to get it out. We think that it's very, very ambitious, but we're going to try it out with some data. We have some data that's been offered to us to put into it, and if we might just go back and look for a little funding to convert one big set of data and a few private sets of data. In other words, there's a large database or discography that's available to us if we do a little conversion for it, and then there's some others that have been done on home systems, and just try it out and see what we can do. The goal is that when it's done, is it for to be public domain, for people to be able to use it. The goal, and this is something I've argued with people for years about, if you remember the old certs ad, is it a discography or is it a catalog? I think we can do both if we do it properly. I think it can be both a breath mint and a candy mint with the proper schema that would, and particularly if we stay with the vocabulary and with the authority work that libraries have invested so much money in and adapt those and maybe even add to them. So stay tuned. In the meantime, I'll just have a quick ad. You talked about our database. On the very opposite end, the Library of Congress is about to put up Jack Raymond's Show Music on Record as a discography. And it'll be up in about a month, and we'll put something up on the ARSC list and on 78L. And Jack's, you know Jack from speaking here, but it is the definitive discography of theater music by original performers and film music. And it was a big WordPerfect file. We spent you know, years converting it to an Access database. We'll be adding to it, and it'll be up and free. But it's not a discography the way I'm talking about. It doesn't deal with matrix numbers. It doesn't deal with recording dates. It's show and performer based. But I just want to tell you to stay tuned, because that's not vaporware. That is really will be out in just a few weeks. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Richard, if you haven't ever visited the virtual gramophone, you have missed a real treat. It is, you know, if you're looking for any best practices, go to Richard's site.
How many people have visited the virtual gramophone? For those of you that haven't, all this stuff that they're talking about, we've gone ahead and done. It's a multimedia, multi-format discography website concentrating on 78s in Canada. If you search our database, you'll find links to sound recordings, to images of the labels, to biographies of many of the performers, to film clips, to other websites. It's all interconnected. There's a lot of information up there. We've initially followed Kurt's guidelines on the cataloging fields. I forget how many fields we've got, but it wasn't enough. So we have lots of practical experience of trying to put something like that into focus. We've been up about 6 years now. We've gone through about 8 phases of content. The first phase was the early Canadian Berliners, both the ones that we had on hand and the ones that we knew about but didn't have the records for. We've done music from World War I, Quebec music, mostly in French, but a lot of fiddle music, more fiddle music than our sound recording person ever wants to listen to again. Some of it was even in tune. We've done some music from the 1920s. In the last phase that just went up a couple of weeks ago, we've done 300 additional Berliner recordings that we've added to the collection. We're starting to do a whole series of Canadian classical vocalists, people like Edward Johnson, Florence Easton, and on. We're still working on that, and then we're going to do some of the classical instrumentalists. The next phase is going to have more text. We've kind of laid off the text side of things, the history of different record companies, artist bios, and so on, but we're going to pick that up again. And we're also probably going to do the early Columbia records that have Canadian performers. This year is the 100th anniversary of Columbia in Canada, so we're going to try and hit them up for some money for that. I don't know if that will work. If you haven't been on the site for the last couple of months, you should go. It's been completely redesigned, which was a major effort. We have a kind of a new look. We have some educational features for anybody that's teaching and wants to use the website for educational purposes. We've tried to make it more intuitive. Some people didn't know what a database was, so we've changed it to search and that kind of stuff. Looking ahead, we are also going to, hopefully, and I'm not sure whether this is a good thing or a bad thing, right now we're a standalone database using Oracle, and we want to, or at least I've been told we want to, put it into the library's mainframe computer, the system known as Amicus. It would tie all the fields into a MARC format. I'm told with the changes in the Amicus system that we'll still retain all the functionality of being able to look and browse in fields like matrix number, take number, label, sub-label, and so on. I'm told that all will all still be there. But the advantage will be that if you're a library or another institution, you'll be able to freely download and transfer the 78 records into your own computer. There's no charge for downloading from Amicus. All you have to do is register. So that will be something that we'll be working on over the next year. I'm told it's still going to be functional, but and we'll still have all the links to the label scans and the biographies and so on. We had a bit of a scare last year. We have a very conservative interpretation of copyright right at the moment, and the people in charge thought we were violating trademarks by putting up all the label scans. Our initial legal opinion was that we weren't, but they have reinterpreted it, and fortunately, most of the record companies have given us permission to use their trademarks, so that was a relief. We have an extensive set of cataloging rules, which I've shared with Bill Klinger and the AVRL people. We have lots of practical experience in trying to put things into practice. both in terms of using discographies to create cataloging records, but also to use that information and then link it to an actual image of a record and the record label that we have on hand. And there's lots of complications that have come up. Just to give you an idea where we're at now, currently there's about 12,000 separate entries in the database. They're all based on single side. If there was more than one take, then there's more than one cataloging record in the database. We've got about 12,000. There are about 3,500 audio files available in both Real Audio and MP3. In Canada, those are all public domain. You are free to download them and use them, play them for your friends, whatever you like. When we first put up the website, I think the first month we might have had a few hundred hits, and maybe the first year we had 5,000 visits, roughly like that. I'm always fond of saying that the current or the previous national librarian said, there's already too much music on the internet, don't think of doing any more. The people that put it up on the website, the library's website, said, oh, you've got a lot of hits this month, but next month there won't be any more, because, you know, once you've listened to that stuff, who's going to want to listen to it again? Well, last year in 2003, we had over 350,000 visitors. We had over 1 million songs listened to. Some months we've had over 100,000 songs listened to. So we've had to continually upgrade the server because it's been overloaded with people visiting. The average visitor stays for about 20 to 25 minutes, which is a long time on a website. And generally we've been cited as the model. And I'm just sorry today that because David just asked me last night and I carefully prepared my presentation, that we don't have live access to the internet. But I would encourage you all to go and visit and add to my stats. And keep up justification for our staff. Currently we have about four catalogers working on it. We've got actually two catalogers, one person who does nothing but collection work, taking the records out, picking out the best copy, cleaning the records, looking after the label scan. We've got people, we've got one project supervisor. Our audio person does virtually nothing but copy audio files for the web. He pitches most of the classical ones and does cedar noise reduction. We've got also a project supervisor who's done a great job on the site redesign. We've got other people working on editing and doing the label scans and so on. What really takes the time in the cataloging is establishing the name authorities for the composers, because in Canada the rule is 50 years from the death of the composer and or lyricist. So before we can go ahead and put those up in the website, we have to make sure that those people are good and dead. And that takes a long time. And so every now and then you hear a little cheer when somebody died before 1953. We get a little sadistic, but hey. So we're looking ahead, and so far we've got funding again for the next year, and we hope to add more and more content, and we hope people will come and visit and come again and again. The site's been a big success, and we have lots of experience that I'm more than happy to share with people who are thinking of doing something on the web.
Thank you very much. He had eight sentences written down on a piece of paper. And
actually, I should mention that next year the library and the archives are going to merge. And all our URLs are going to change because we're going to have a new address for the library, for Library and Archives Canada, if I can get the name right. So I'm not quite sure what the long-term future is, but if you just go and search on Google and put in virtual gramophone, you'll go right to the website.
Thank you. Time is slipping away from me here. Let me just briefly mention again XML. Some of you have gotten into web pages and you're familiar with HTML at least, hypertext markup language. All of these markup languages are related. And all they are, you know, they're not databases themselves, they're just ways to mark up information so that either a database or a word processor or whatever will know what to do with it. With HTML, it's so the browser knows what to do with the text. So let's say you wanted to have a piece of text, maybe it's, you just got this something or other on your website and you want it to change. You've got a nice layout, everything's in a standard color, but you decide that this piece of information needs to be in a different color for some reason. All you would do is mark it up by saying, oh, maybe something like font color equals blue. Right? And then just boom. And the font. And that tells it to stop doing whatever you just told it to do when it gets to that point. This is your markup language. Now, you can do it yourself with XML, extensible markup language. Sam talked about schemas. That is a way for you to take all of this information, tag it so that these other applications can import it and use it. Access now has XML features, and it should be able to, if you supply it with the schema, say we publish it on the internet, put that address in there, Access should be smart enough to take your XML file, associate it with, say, Sam's schema, and know how many fields to generate, how big they should be, all that good stuff. It probably won't work as well as we think it will, but it shows potential. And, you know, we've talked about the databases having trouble talking to each other. Word processors have trouble talking to each other. Microsoft Word for Works will not talk to Microsoft Word for Office. Don't ask me why. Okay, so we can devise our own scheme where let's say you'd use this to highlight a piece of text in an HTML file. And the reason you highlighted it was because it was, maybe it was from another source than the rest of your record. It would be great if instead of just telling it, I'll change the font color, because I know why I want to change the font color. Let's say that there's a piece of information in this markup language that would tell any database or any word processor or any browser why it's happening, and then it can deal with it properly. And you don't have to worry about restating this thing all the time. Maybe we would say, let's say source, and we could say, I don't know. Let's say it came from one of Brian Russ's books. So we'd say source equals Russ Jazz Records. If we had a schema up there on the internet someplace, then we have to change this too. And that's the end of the source. If I could spell right at this point in my life, I'd be fine. So now you've identified this as coming from a particular source. And so if your schema said everything that comes from, say, Brian Russ Jazz Records ought to be in chartreuse, you can do that. And any application that you transport it to, if it's smart enough to figure out XML, would have instructions on how to handle that. So, you know, if I just put on my HTML file, color it green, if you try and transport all that information to, say, a database, you know, there's no way for it to know that it's green because it's Brian Russ material. It just says, oh, okay, we'll keep it green. You said so. My main concern right now, especially with 78s, is that if you look around this room, the heads are getting grayer. The people who actually understand 78s, who can look at one and tell what its origins are, who can figure out ones from 1Rs and that sort of thing, we're going to be falling by the wayside. Not right away, I hope. But the numbers are going to diminish. And unless we take the expertise that we've got and incorporate it into these electronic systems so that the people who come after us don't have to figure it out. Something prompts them, then a lot of information is just going to disappear. A lot of information has already disappeared. But this gives us hope. If we can get together and devise a schema which controls all these things, then we're in much better shape. And we can get past a lot of the discussions we've had about standards in the past. We've had some pretty acrimonious debates, because anybody who's interested in jazz discography has some fairly set ideas about what goes into one. And they don't correspond all that well to someone who does classical discography, who doesn't really care about the entire personnel of the Cleveland Orchestra. It's a very different animal. And that calls for a relational database when you're trying to match orchestras with performances and sessions. Okay. What time are we supposed to wrap up? We got 3 minutes. Any questions? Let's see. I guess. Well, you're right up front. I'll get you.
On the virtual gramophone, do you have any identifier to indicate that this is these audio files are in public domain?
Well, when you click on it, the metadata shows that it's put in public domain.
In Canada.
In Canada.
So, in other words, the RIAA doesn't give a damn about Canada's public domain.
Well, anything you publish in Canada is governed by Canadian copyright law. If we went to do the same thing in the United States, we'd be governed under American copyright law. The fact that you can go on from anywhere in the world, and we've had visitors from all over the world, and download the songs, that's not my problem.
They're using songs recorded in Canada.
No. Any song recorded anywhere, as long as it's been fixated more than 50 years. So it's 50 in Canada, it's 50 years from the fixation of the record.
So the point is, if I'm downloading it on our university computer, and we've got some of the spies at the university looking over our shoulders under the auspices of the RIAA, would they complain?
If you downloaded it, I don't think they would. But if you went to put it up on your own website again, then yes, they would.
But there's no telling.
You know. Yeah, what you do with it after you download it, that's not my problem. I'm just concerned with the Canadian law.
Yeah, they can't get him.
Richard, was that 50 years after the recording was fixed or after the death of the artist?
The artist, in the last copyright revision in Canada, they added a performance right, but it expires 50 years after the fixation of the record. So that's anything after 19...
Corporate copyright, not individual copyright.
Well, there's three rights on a sound recording in Canada. There's the one for the recording, and that's 50 years from the fixation. There's one for the music and the lyrics, and that's 50 years from the death of the composer and or lyricist. And then there's the performance right, a neighboring right it's called, and that's 50 years from the fixation of the record as well. So if we're talking anything that's older than 1953, then the only right we have to worry about in Canada are the music and lyrics.
Sarah?
Our first legal opinion when we started 6 years ago was that those would be in public domain. But subsequently, there's been questions raised about the use of the trademark that appears on the labels. And so we have approached the record companies in Canada that have the rights to those trademarks. And generally speaking, we've gotten pretty good cooperation on that.
Would you address that?
I'm not a trademark attorney. I mean, I think that, you know, institutions have, depending on the day, lawyers and attorneys who decide what acceptable risk is. And in many cases, they, maybe because they know that Americans are downloading and you know, these things are illegal here, technically, they don't want to mess with the trademark. It could be anything. I personally think if you're not using the trademark to compete with that record company to do the same thing they did when they were selling them. You're safe, but I'm not an attorney. That was a stupid thing for me to say, actually. I have no right to say that. It's just sort of, you know, when you get sued, though, you say, well, what was the harm to you? And I don't think that any record company could prove that someone downloaded this because it was Columbia. You know, we weren't trading on the reputation of Columbia Records or Victor. But I don't blame them for being safe. We you know, the library's stretching. Our attorneys have made some very interesting decisions recently on music on the net. And I don't want to get into it because it's not what this session's about. But it is a matter of acceptable risk. And it's changing every day. It will change. And this 50-year law is going to change. At least, you know, there's going to be pressure on them to change. As it gets into the rock and roll era, there will be pressure by American companies on European and Canadian companies to change that law. Whether it happens, I don't know.
But, well, given the speed at which copyright legislation goes through Parliament, hopefully we'll escape that.
Yeah. But, I mean, this is what happened in America. The law was 70 years until it got to the real lucrative copyrights, until it got into the heart of the what we call standards, you know, the Gershwin-Kern stuff. And that's what's happening with the record industry. You know, it's getting toward the rock era, that 50 years, and there's going to be pressure to change it.
Okay. We'll be available to discuss these things informally later.
Oh, there's one question from the back. The gentleman had his hand up.
Yes.
It just takes somebody to sit down and map out the data.
Yeah.
Right.
Relatively, for someone who's very familiar with databases.
Right.
I'm not saying it's impossible. I'm saying it can be difficult.
Okay, these gentlemen will be around for the rest of the meeting, so you can ask them additional questions. Let's thank them for their session. I'd like to ask you to try to get back here at 1:00. We have a joint session with Sam on, where was it? music downloading and file swapping. So that will be back here at 1:00.
Nice to see you. Until I got that email.